financing and administering massive entitlement programs, enormous government bailouts, seemingly endless wars, and runaway big government have sunk America into a quagmire of deficit, debt, and inflation. Is there any hope for recovery? What does the future hold? Dr. David Jeremiah examines these issues as he begins his new series on the present and future economic changes and uncertainties in our world, the coming economic Armageddon. Now here's David to introduce the first message in this new series, The Fall of the American Economy.
Well, thank you for joining us today. I remember studying through the series, What in the World is Going On? And I began to notice that there was a line that sort of drew all of these thoughts together, and it had to do with finances. I began to study that and realize that there is quite a financial theme through the prophetic scriptures, and so today we began that study with the foundational message on the fall of the American economy. What has happened in our nation? I'm going to be very frank and very honest. It is my purpose to tell the truth about what I've learned, and I hope that you will listen carefully and begin to pray with me about the future of this nation. We are so excited about this series and about this book that we want to make this book available to you for a gift of any size. And today is the last day that we can unlock the digital resource library for those of you who pre-order this book. So when you order the book today, online or over the phone, we will give you the code and you can unlock this incredible resource library. But this is the last day, so don't wait any longer. Order the book today through Turning Point and go to davidjeremiah.org. There you will find a way to do it. We also want to remind you that we're right on the threshold of the beginning of our rallies for the fall. On Thursday, October the 14th, we're going to be in Greensboro, North Carolina at the Greensboro Coliseum at 7 p.m. And then on the 4th of November in Washington, D.C. at the Verizon Center. And then on November the 18th in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, we'll be at the Consol Energy Center. And we want to invite you to come and be with us. The tickets are free, but you must get tickets. You can get them by going to the Turning Point website or calling our order line, and we'll be happy to respond to your request and get your tickets to you so that you will have them in plenty of time for the event. But as I look at my calendar, the Greensboro event is just 2 weeks away. It's going to be a wonderful night with Charles Billingsley and the Hoppers and all of the Turning Point team, and I'll be teaching from this series, The Coming Economic Armageddon, and I hope that you will come and be with us. That's Greensboro, North Carolina, on Thursday, October the 14th. Well, with a sense of responsibility and a sense of God's direction and leading, we open our hearts to this teaching on the coming economic Armageddon. This first message will give a lot of background material, and we will finish up our discussion of the fall of the American economy on Tuesday and Wednesday. But let's begin our discussion as we ask God to give us wisdom and direction.
For as long as I can remember, I have been a patriot. I love this country. Way back when I first started in the ministry as a young pastor, when we had 4th of July, I didn't know if you were supposed to do this or not, if it was right, but we just had a big blowout celebration of what it means to be an American. We've been doing that ever since. We never do it without getting a letter or two from somebody who says it's probably not right for us to do that. But I usually read the letters and we keep doing it. And so that's all right. I don't think that I am an overreactor. I'm kind of laid back when it comes to stuff like this, but I got to tell you, I really got steamed up about what's going on, not only in our world, but primarily in our own nation. And let's face it, it hasn't gotten any better. And so what I want to do is tell you what I've learned. I've spent this time trying to sort this all out. I need to tell you, we're going to get to the Bible, but not till the clear end of the message. So don't think I've quit being a preacher now and gone to being a lecturer. I have to set this up right so that you understand how this all fits together. And so I want to tell you the story of what I've learned about the fall of the American economy. Bernard Madoff will no doubt go down in history as Wall Street's most notorious criminal. He systematically cheated investors out of $65 billion, far eclipsing the 1980s insider trading scandals involving junk bond financiers Michael Milken and Ivan Bosky. Among the thousands of Madoff's victims were a number of Hollywood celebrities such as Kevin Bacon and Kara Sedgwick, Zsa Zsa Gabor and her ninth husband lost almost $10 million. Director Steven Spielberg and DreamWorks executive Jeffrey Katzenberg lost money they had invested for their Wonderkind Foundation. Other celebrities who fell victim to Bernie Madoff were CNN's Larry King, former baseball great Sandy Koufax, and John Robbins of the Baskin-Robbins ice cream family. Also affected were prominent New York financial figures, some of the country's leading Jewish charities, Jewish patriot Elie Wiesel. Thousands of elderly retirees lost their entire life savings. And oh yes, Madoff's own sister, whom he scammed out of $3 million. Madoff took money from investors and used their money to pay out profits to earlier investors. As long as the new money kept coming into the system, it worked like a charm. His investors prospered, and he promised to continue the bountiful flow of steady income, 12 to 20% returns, he promised. Impossible? Of course it is, but he delivered on his promises. And when anyone would ask him how he did it, he would answer with some gobbledygook about split-strike conversion strategies or investing from London. If he was pressed too hard, he would get angry and refuse to answer. His clients should be grateful for his wizardry. Quit looking for the levers behind the curtain. Well, some of his investors certainly assumed that he was cheating. But they did not press for details for fear of killing the goose that was delivering the golden eggs. As investment advisor Suzanne Murphy once said, it was a great con. The best cons are when you keep the pigeons happy, right? And the pigeons were happy because they were getting good returns. Madoff did not have to put ads in the Wall Street Journal to build his business. Customers were banging on his door, begging him to let them in. Some of his oldest friends would come up to him and practically beg him to take their trust funds. Madoff's charm was that he outfoxed the foxes, he outscammed the scammers. In the history of high-stakes gambling, he outdid them all. Like Robin Hood with Alzheimer's, he stole from the rich if only he had remembered to give to the poor. Everybody would have liked him. Bernie Madoff, as you know, was arrested, pleaded guilty to 11 federal offenses, and in June of 2009, he was sentenced to 150 years in prison. Once worth millions, Madoff now lives at North Carolina Federal Prison, and according to a court report that I read, he eats pizza cooked by a child molester, sleeps in the lower bunk in a cell he shares with a 21-year-old druggie, and spends his time with a former Colombo crime boss and a spy for Israel. Now, 8 decades before Bernie Madoff's crimes, Charles Ponzi held the record as the greatest swindler in American history. Actually, the term Ponzi scheme is widely known as a description of any scam that pays early investors with ill-gotten funds from later investors. Ponzi's scheme began shortly at the end of the First World War in the start of the Roaring Twenties. He promised his clients a 50% profit within 45 days or 100% profit within 90 days. And in the end, Ponzi was charged with 88 counts of mail fraud. He spent 3.5 years in a federal prison, and before being deported to his native Italy, there he died in a charity hospital in 1949. Now, one would think that Bernie Madoff wins hands down as the number one Ponzi perpetrator of all time. But if you compare his scheme to what's going on today in America's system of finance, Bernie Madoff is just an amateur. Financing and administering massive entitlement programs and wars and runaways and big government has sunk our nation into a quagmire of deficits and debts and inflation. And our government seems to see no way out except to continue the policies that created the problems in the first place, to spend and borrow at an ever-increasing pace until the entire system falls on its face, exhausted from trying to outrun itself. This national Ponzi scheme was predicted 20 centuries ago in the New Testament letter of James and figures prominently as a sign of the coming economic Armageddon, and we'll look at that shortly. We're going to look at some of the causes and effects and the meaning of how Madoff-like greed and fiscal irresponsibility are contributing to the coming fall of the American economy. Let's begin, first of all, with Social Security. One of the earliest triggers of financial instability in America was the inception of Social Security. I'll be honest with you, when I began to study this, I was sort of under the impression that Social Security was quite a bit older than it really is. Roosevelt saw the Social Security Act in 1935 as a massive measure to assure young people who were wondering about what would happen to them when they got old. And he wanted to give them some measure of protection so that the family would be protected against the loss of a job and maybe poverty-ridden old age. Maybe the first part of it was okay, but like all entitlement programs, it didn't stay by itself very long. In just 4 years of passing the Social Security Act, Congress amended the program to include survivor's insurance. In 1965, Medicare benefits were added. By 2008, Social Security and Medicare had swollen to such a massive entitlement program, making it necessary to raise more than $1 trillion, or one-third of the federal budget. Today, Social Security functions like an unfunded entitlement program. While it is true that the government has raked in more in Social Security payroll taxes than it pays out in benefits, that money is not protected in any trust fund, as many are led to believe. The government uses the Social Security funds to pay for other programs. There is no such thing as a Social Security trust fund. There is no lockbox. Social Security operates exactly like the schemes of Charles Ponzi and Bernard Madoff. New contributors to the program fund the promises made to the older contributors. American workers who have faithfully paid their Social Security tax every year are relying on empty federal purses to fulfill its promise to them. And according to most economists, we are about to enter the perfect storm. As New York Times economics reporter Edmund Andrews reports, the nation's oldest baby boomers are approaching 65. Setting off what experts have warned for years will be a physical nightmare for the government. What a good country or a good squirrel should do is stashing away nuts for the winter, said one writer. And the United States is not only saving nuts, it's eating the ones left over from last year. The first baby boomers are going to reach full retirement in 2012, but they've been eligible to collect reduced payouts since 2008, and they will be eligible for Medicare in 2011. In the very near future, nearly 80 million more squirrels are going to be scavenging in earnest for the few nuts that are still there in the government's quote-unquote trust fund. So Social Security has become one of our most ominous, unsustainable programs, leading to unending deficits. Richard Lamb, who is the former governor of Colorado, summed it up like this. He said, "Christmas is a time when kids tell Santa what they want and the adults pay for it. Deficits are when adults tell the government what they want and their kids pay for it." Former CEO of the United States Government Accounting Office, David M. Walker, has written, "If I were a young American looking at this kind of future, I would be marching out in front of the nation's capital, waving a sign that protested taxation without representation." Well, you take Social Security and put it aside for a moment. Let's talk a little bit about war and national defense. I don't know if you'll be surprised at this, but I was shocked that in 2008, 41.5% of all the military expenditures in the entire world belong to the United States. We spent more on national defense than China, Japan, Russia, Europe, and several other nations combined. In 2009, our defense budget was $642 billion, second only to Social Security, which is $677 billion. Our defense costs were 36% of the total income from taxes in fiscal year 2009. Economist Joseph Stiglitz, who is a Nobel Prize writer, and his co-author, Linda Bilmes, wrote a book about the cost of our current war, including its hidden costs. And the book's title tells everything you need to know. The $3 trillion war. Many who praised the book said its only failure was understating the cost by at least another trillion. I don't know that I really get into all that, but once in a while somebody will say it in a way that you can't forget. I promise you, you won't forget this. Joe Belts of World Magazine put these astronomical figures into focus. He said, Wherever you stand on increasing our forces in Afghanistan, you'll have to concede that war is expensive. In round numbers, by some estimates, it costs $1 million per soldier per year to send someone to Iraq or Afghanistan. $1 million per soldier per year. Clearly, the cost of war and national defense is another drain on our national economy. And while we are all committed to having a strong defense, I'm just telling you the story and painting the picture. Then what can we say about the growth of government? The size of the United States government began to balloon back during the presidency of Franklin Delano Roosevelt as his New Deal attempted to address the misery of the Great Depression. According to a recent State Department report, the rise of the United States as the world's major military power during and after World War II also fueled government growth. Greater expectations led to significant government investment in schools and colleges, and an enormous national push for scientific and technological advances spawned all these new agencies and substantial public investment in fields ranging from space exploration to health care. And it's not just the federal government that continues to grow. According to the same report, between 1960 and 1990, the number of state and local government employees increased from 6.4 million to 15.2 million. Today, the United States government is our nation's largest employer. The December 2009 total payroll for federal government employees rang up at $15,471,672,417. Back in 1900, only 1 in 24 Americans worked for the government. By 1948, that rose over 500% to 1 in 8. In 2009, there are nearly 2 million federal employees. And that number is projected to rise by 15% in the fiscal year 2010. In 1900, 1 in 24 worked for some government agency or national or local government. 1948, it was 1 in 8, and today it's 1 in 5. And so the uncontrolled growth of big government is killing our nation financially. Here's the problem with big government. Listen, there is no product. There's no product. We invest all this money in the government, and what do we get back? Well, we get some services and all the things that we need, but we don't produce anything that can create new revenue, and so we're throwing all this money into the government, and I don't think it's going to get better, at least not in the near future. Let's talk for a few moments about debt. I don't know, you probably didn't come here to hear about debt, but I'm going to talk about it anyway, so just hang in there. It won't take long. In 2009, USA Today reported that with the national debt now topping $12 trillion, the White House estimates that the government's tab for servicing the debt will exceed $700 billion a year in 2019, up from $202 billion this year. Just one of the wrenching challenges facing the United States after decades of living beyond our means. David Walker adds, "We have created big government programs, but we try to finance them with small government taxes. And that spells deficits and debt, and it will spell insolvency for the government and a lot worse for America if we don't fix it." Physical economists use a term that designates the cause and magnitude of our debt. I had to go to school on this. Here's a phrase. You may have heard it. The infinite horizon discounted value. What does that mean? Well, this term represents a highly complicated formula that determines the value of all promised benefits, current and future, in terms of our present-day dollars going forward into the future. In other words, how do we know how much we owe Social Security? They have to come up with a formula to look at how much money is going to be owed to the people who will matriculate during this period of time. In the process, they have to try to determine the value that the dollar will have in that particular year going forward. And so the formula they use to do that is called infinite horizon discounted value. And that helps you to understand what our real indebtedness problem is in order for us to try to fund all the things we have said we're going to fund. Unfortunately, Social Security is not our greatest problem, even though the gap for Social Security is $17.5 trillion. Social Security isn't the biggest problem. Medicare is many times worse. Our current Medicare program has three separate centers of coverage and funding. For instance, Medicare A is for hospital stays. Medicare B covers doctor's visits. And then the new part, Medicare D, covers prescriptions. That was just put into effect in 2006 under President George Bush. Now, let me tell you what the unfunded liability of these entitlement programs are. I never saw these numbers before, but we've checked them over and over again, and this is something we didn't make this up. The current unfunded liability for Medicare Part A is $36.7 trillion. For Part B is $37 trillion. For Part D is $15.6 trillion. The total liability of all three unfunded Medicare programs is $89.3 trillion. This is five times as much as the unfunded Social Security bill. So if you add the unfunded liability of all three parts of Medicare to the unfunded liability of Social Security, you come up with a figure of $106.8 trillion. Now, add to that our national debt, which is $12 trillion, but they've just recently raised the ceiling to $14.2, so it won't take long for us to get there, as you well know. The total unfunded liability, our debt, is $118.8 trillion. That amounts to a debt load of $383,000 per person. If you happen to be here with a family of four, your tally is $1,532,000 if we're going to get this debt paid off by surcharging it out to everybody who lives in our nation. Now, here's the problem, folks. America's debt at any level, $12 trillion, it's not going to be paid. We will simply roll it over again and again until America's creditors are unwilling to loan any money to us. The nation is in the same position as someone who has taken a cash advance from his Visa card to meet his mortgage payment and then has taken out a new MasterCard credit line to pay off his Visa bill. Credit card debt juggling may appear to work in the short run, but it is a road to financial ruin. And just as compound interest is said to be the investor's best friend, compound debt is the worst nightmare you can come up with. So far, we've been addressing only the debt itself. Let's just talk about interest for a moment. If you have a mortgage on your home, as we do, you have probably experienced a reaction similar to mine when I get that statement every year and realize how much I pay on interest and how little of it goes to principal. If you've got a new home and you mortgage your home, you financed your home, for the first few years, you seem like all you're doing is paying interest, and you don't ever reduce the debt very much. Well, if you think that's discouraging, consider the U.S. government's fiscal year-end interest statement. According to the White House Office of Management and Budget, $904 billion came into the Treasury through tax payments at the end of 2009. The interest on our national debt was $383 billion, not the principal, just the interest. This means that the cost of interest on the debt represented more than 40 cents of every dollar that came in from individual income tax, and that does not even touch the principal.
Well, I know that's a lot of information. If you've listened carefully, it's not a pretty picture, and I'm not finished with this. So be sure and join us tomorrow as we continue our discussion of the American economy. When this whole thing descended upon my spirit after the series that I did recently, it consumed me for almost a whole year. I did nothing but study and read and try to understand what was happening in my country and where was it all going and what was the reason for it. And some of the answers are yet ahead in this series, The Coming Economic Armageddon. Don't forget, when you send a gift to Turning Point during the month of October, we want to send you a copy of this brand new book. This brand new hardback is available now for a gift of any size from Turning Point. Of course, you can go to your local bookseller and you can find it there. If you want to help Turning Point in a special way, you can order it from us and we'll be happy to send it to you by return mail. Well, tomorrow we will continue with our discussion of the fall of the American economy. Don't forget also that Thursday, October the 14th, we're going to be in Greensboro, North Carolina. We'll have a pastor's breakfast in the morning, and our rally is at the Coliseum at 7 p.m. Be sure to order your tickets through our website or by calling our order line. And we'll see you right back here tomorrow on the next edition of Turning Point.
The message you heard today originated in the pulpit of Shadow Mountain Community Church, where David serves as senior pastor. Please take a moment to share what God is doing in your life through this ministry by writing to Turning Point, Post Office Box 3838, San Diego, California 92163. You can also contact us when you visit our website at davidjeremiah.org/radio or call 800-947-1993. When you call or visit online, request this month's resource, The Coming Economic Armageddon. This new book by Dr. David Jeremiah addresses aspects of the current and future economic changes in our world, and it reminds us to keep our trust in God alone, our only true source of safety and security. It's yours today for a gift of any amount. Just visit davidjeremiah.org/radio. This is Mark Larson. Join us tomorrow as we continue the series, The Coming Economic Armageddon, on Turning Point with Dr. David Jeremiah.